This is the beginning of side number one of tape number six of the autobiography revised concerning events between June 1944 and May 1945. Vicky remained conscious the whole time and remarkably calm. We talked to him and he asked me what his legs were actually like. I, of course, didn't dare tell him. The fact is, they were a tangled mess. One of them ultimately had to be taken off above the knee, in the thigh, and the other one came off below the knee. But at that time, they were both so entangled in such a mess that one couldn't tell one from the other. Meanwhile, we had to get help in two ways. Stan Triggs got on the radio, first of all, to get stretcher bearers so that we could get Vicky away. But also, we were in a very vulnerable position there in this little circle of mist. We could have been attacked at any time, so we did need some kind of reinforcement. If the Germans had come out of the mist, we could all have been taken prisoner without any difficulty at all. If not worse. Perhaps the most pathetic thing that we had to endure at that time was to hear Vickery say, "Just tell me, have I any life left?" And we said, "Yes, plenty." But I don't think we said it with a great deal of conviction. I certainly didn't. So there we remained in a defensive position round the carrier until the ambulance and the stretcher bearers arrived. And when they came, that was the last I saw of Norman Vickery in action, and I was terribly, terribly cut up. It cut me up probably more than anything else that I'd seen from the Normandy beach onwards, because we had been so close in all the actions. Incidentally, they never did send out any reinforcement to help us defend that position, but the mist eventually lifted and we proceeded on to the farm. So we carried out our watching brief on the farm for the rest of that day, but surprise, surprise, the farmer himself had disappeared. What this had to do with what had happened to us, we never really found out. If we were charitable, we might say that the Germans kidnapped him. But I've always half suspected that he shot us. The fact was that earlier in the week, one of our carriers had come in and run down into his cesspit. That is to say that he'd gone over a particularly soft bit and caved it in. We got the carrier out, or I didn't go right down into it, but we could tell that he didn't like that, and he didn't like us at all. Farming folk don't like soldiers around their farms. They don't seem to have any real sense of urgency when there's a war on. They've got a farm to run. And I think he was no exception. But as I say, I wonder always whether he shopped us. He may well have done so. Certainly his attitude was never more than merely acquiescent. Hospitality was never on the cards at all. However, nobody is ever going to prove things one way or the other now. But if he left the farm, we certainly didn't. We merely made our ways to it by a different route every day. We didn't get caught like that again. But we did continue to use it for our lookout, and eventually were able to witness the Americans in another piece of black humor, this time a little more tragic than before. I mentioned earlier the promise of these men in the 7th American Armored Division to clear everything away in front of our damn canal that we weren't going to have to worry about. And after a few days had passed since Vicky's departure, we witnessed a rather bizarre attempt to do it. They turned up one day with two or three most astonishing-looking, I suppose, armoured scout cars. But they looked more like DeLorean cars. They looked like luxury family cars writ large, rather than armoured cars. And I suppose it was all on the surface. They looked very efficient, but the fact is they didn't have any armour on them at all. And they turned up with these things, presumably to clear all the land in front of us, between us and the canal. Well, we could have told them that if they start moving around in the fields just in front of us, they were looking for trouble. But they snubbed us completely. They didn't come anywhere near our farm, even though we waved at them. But they didn't come and ask us anything which we might have been able to tell them. Presumably our credentials with them were no better than those of the Germans themselves. You wouldn't really have thought that we were fighting the same war. So off they went about a field away from us, on the other side of a hedge, in country that we wouldn't dare to have gone into. And the strange thing was that these two or three vehicles were followed on foot by some officers who were looking at it curiously, almost as if they were trying out a new kind of plough or something. It was quite the oddest behaviour we'd seen. Needless to say, sooner or later, the inevitable happened. They hit some mines, a couple of them went up, and members of the crew were either killed or wounded. The officers did look surprised. Well, it hadn't seemed as if, up to that point, the normal rules of life and death applied to them. And I don't think we could call that courage. It was simply pure foolhardiness. But perhaps it was foolhardiness, too, that we continued to use this farm as an OP, because 3 days later, it was duly shelled. And a certain Rifleman Smith was wounded. I can't remember Rifleman Smith. I only remember him by name. But he couldn't have been with us very long. He must have been a reinforcement from the King's Royal Rifles. Anyway, after that episode, we were well and truly rumbled, so we never went there again. In any case, it was time to move on. Incidentally, we were still very badly cut up in the company. We were right down to two effective motor platoons, and those were the two that were out on the canal bank every night, and only one other carrier section apart from ourselves. There are only two carrier sections and two motor platoons left in the company. And there'd have to be a great deal of reorganization and regrouping of the company before we were able to move on from De Rips and resume the advance. And the most sensational piece of regrouping and reorganization, so far as I was concerned, was the fact that I received immediate promotion to full corporal to replace Norman Vickery. So we left De Rips on October the 15th, on which day the 3rd British Division attacked Vedrai from the north. We got mixed up in this action more or less as a counter-movement from our side. 14 platoon got across the bridge, later followed by 15, and sooner or later the whole company got into Vedrai, and we formed a small bridgehead on that side of the canal. And overnight, the Royal Engineers came up and they built a Bailey Bridge across, and we were able to get all the vehicles over and reinforce the bridgehead that we'd made. We didn't find this very troublesome, and on the 16th, we were over it and really dug in, and then relieved by the Inns of Court Regiment. On the following day, there was a nasty battle on the Vedrai-Derna road, but it didn't concern our carrier platoon very much. But we did get stonked by a moaning Mini, and one of these fell beside the carrier, which the platoon commander, Johnny Straker, Captain Straker, was, and his driver, Huckle, Johnny Huckle, he was killed. Rifleman Buttress, the wireless operator, was wounded, and so was Johnny Straker himself. So we'd lost another carrier and three very valuable men. As a matter of fact, it's the second time that Johnny Straker had been wounded. The first time was in Normandy when he checked a man for not wearing a steel helmet, and he turned out to be a German who shot at him. That was in Saint-Martin-de-Bezas in Normandy, and the episode is still remembered by the village. Not, I may say, without a touch of amusement to this day. But although our carrier platoon was not directly involved very much in this battle, 14 and 15, our two remaining motor platoons, had a bit of a soaking. They lost a platoon commander, Lieutenant Ryan, and a Spandau killed him and Rifleman Hopper, and a certain Rifleman Collier, who was actually going up to see if he could do something about the four or five wounded that they also suffered, and on his way he got killed himself. So it wasn't a very good day for them, and their numbers were further thinned down. On the 18th and 19th, we didn't have much by way of battle, but a great deal of strain. The weather had turned bad, and the war had become a lot grimmer than it had been. The shelling was naggingly insistent and stomach-churning, and the situation wasn't greatly helped by the fact that the civilian population appeared all to have evacuated. We were going through one deserted village after another, and it was all very depressing, not to say enervating. And the 19th found us in the village of Leunen, L-E-U-N-E-N. We were destined to be in Leunen for about a week, and none of us, I think, has ever thought of that village since, except as associated with pigs and pork. It was an agricultural area that had been evacuated by the civilians because of the fighting that was going on, and they were apparently predominantly a pig-rearing farming stock. But as they got away themselves, of course, they had to leave their animals more or less to die. I remember one poor unfortunate porker that had happened to fall into a hole and he couldn't climb out of it. And in his starvation, curiously enough, his body had become bloated, and we couldn't have got him out under any circumstances. All we could have done was shoot him, but we didn't at that time have the nerve. Well, in any case, it wasn't tactically sensible because we didn't want the Germans particularly to know that we were there. It was a bit early for that. So there were pigs absolutely everywhere, and therefore plenty of pork to eat, so long as you had the stomach for it, in view of the ever-threatening shelling and enervating circumstances that surrounded us. Apart from anything else, all these pigs around were quite a menace to our defences. It was really quite like World War I, really, in this position, because we and the Germans were both in the same boat. They were equally under strain, not very far away, a few hundred yards, I suppose, and both of us were sending out patrols to find out what the other one was up to. So to have all these pigs running around virtually wild was a bit of a menace. We found from night one that they were given to blundering into our tripwires, which were attached to very lights, which would go off in order to let us know not only that the Germans were there, but where they were there. These bright lights were supposed to reveal any marauding bands. But of course, if the pigs walked into them, they went off, and it was a false alarm, and everybody got into a panic and stood to and so on, quite unnecessarily. So after that, we were decided that marauding pigs must be destroyed. And the second night that we were there, there were three little pigs, and this is not a fairy story, but they really were three little piglets, oh, very young, I suppose, about not more than 2 feet long, each one of them. And they were running around in the farm where we were, and I got told off to go and shoot them. Well, I couldn't catch them at first. I had to chase them round a sort of lawn with my 10 gun. And eventually I shot one, and he dropped dead, and I shot another one, and then he dropped dead, and I had a great deal of difficulty in shooting the third, but I eventually got him too. And when he dropped dead on the lawn, everybody virtually applauded because I'd landed them in an exactly straight line from one end of the lawn to the other. If it had been a sport, that would have been a jackpot, but that wasn't really quite what we were on. Anyway, they were delicious a couple of days later. Well, as I say, Leunen was an extremely uncomfortable place. Nasty weather, endless shelling, generally sitting on the front edge of our seats the whole time with a nasty feeling in the pit of the stomach. But it was there that we were rejoined by Lieutenant Neil, who had been platoon commander when we first arrived in Normandy, but he'd been wounded. And now he came back to us, and he was promoted captain, and he commanded our platoon from then onwards in exchange for the unfortunate Johnny Straker, who in turn had been wounded and taken away. Incidentally, in his subsequent career, Brian Neil became a very, very high court judge indeed. He's one of the most senior high court judges in Britain. I also remember that while we were at Leunen, something rather unfortunate happened. One of our jobs, of course, in a position like that, was to guard the tanks, to make sure that the enemy patrols didn't infiltrate our area and put a grenade down the turret or something of that kind. But for some reason, and I can't remember why it was, we were taken away and another regiment came in to take our place for a couple of days. I can't remember what we went to. I'm sure it wasn't a holiday. But anyway, while we were away, something awful happened. The enemy did indeed infiltrate, and they blew up a 23rd Hussar tank. And when we came back, the 23rd Hussars were so glad to see us, they practically kissed us, because they didn't feel so happy with this other regiment that they'd put in our place. Which was very encouraging for us, but it was very sad about the tank. I don't remember whether there was anybody hurt. So Leunen for us characterized a new phase of the war. It was very much more like World War I, as we had read about it. We were wet and muddy and depressed, and the enemy weren't very far away, and it was not very good for morale. The shelling was enervating in the extreme. We were, after all, getting very near to Germany now, and they were sensitive to this, and they were determined that we weren't going to have things easy. And it was now getting near to November, and there was no prospect of the weather getting any better, certainly. And so this added to the general atmosphere of World War I. So it became a situation of stalemate and patrols. The only thing you could say in its favour as a campaign was the fact that the Dutch earth was very soft, very much softer than any other we'd had to dig in, and so we duly exploited this when we were digging our slit trenches. We got down good and deep. So the general war of attrition was assisted in its bloodiness by the fact that although all the other bridges up as far as the Arnhem Drop were firmly in our hands, that particular one was not. And so the Germans were going to be a pretty tough proposition in that area. This meant we had a very bleak winter to look forward to. It would indeed be a war of attrition. We all felt this coming on. In fact, our particular role was becoming very much like an infantry regiment rather than a rifle regiment, the subtle difference I've explained earlier on. And between then and Christmas, it really didn't change very much. It was really a question of just shuffling the battalions around where they could do the best job. We weren't all the time in Leunen. We were only there for a week or so. But for the rest of the time, we were doing similar jobs in this village or that. We would take over from the Hereford's here, and the Hereford's would take over from the Monmouth's there, and the Monmouth's would take over from the Inns of Court somewhere else, and so on and so forth. And it was a kind of game of musical trenches. And it seemed fairly apparent that the same situation existed on the German side. The fact was that neither side wanted to make an adventurous move in the mud. Although there was, at one stage, a note that we were about to go into some rather furious attack somewhere or other, but it seemed that the 15th Scottish Division had done so particularly well on a sector that they were covering, possibly making a minor push of some kind, that it made any interference from us quite unnecessary. Well, bully for them and bully for us. So on the 11th of November, we moved back to Leunen. This time we went into the village itself rather than the farms surrounding, G Company having taken over our old positions. But then we went to a place called Isselstein, and there were one or two false alarms while we were there, battles which we never had to fight, but which seemed to promise, much as they'd promised earlier on when the 15th Scottish bailed us out. And after being in Isselstein for about a week, we went north to Svolgen, S-W-O-L-G-E-N, where we came under command of the 159 Infantry Brigade, who probably didn't regard us as professional infantrymen. So they gave us a rather simple job, as they thought, of guarding a kastel, a castle, a moated house, really, on the banks of the River Maas. Now, although normally surrounded by a moat, this castle was even more isolated than ever, because all the ground was flooded all the way around. The Maas had overflowed its banks, and there was only one road coming from a nearby village which came anywhere near the castle, and that was our only dry land means of communication. But in any case, the road itself was in full view of the enemy, so we could only move around on it at night. We had a week there at that kastel. I remember particularly sharing a guard with an extremely pleasant older man, a member of the 60th Rifles who'd been transferred into us, called Ernie something. He was a rifleman, one of the drivers, and much given to singing little songs under his breath while we were on guard, which was very amusing. He sang songs like, "We keep chickens in our backyard, we feed them on Indian corn." And the other one he sang was, "We are the Liverpool jocks. We don't wear trousers, we wear frocks, and we all stick up for Johnny Knox, because he goes to church on Sundays." He was extremely good company. I'm happy to say that he survived, and he was still good company at the end. On the whole, our week at the Castel was fairly dreary. We were being continually shelled, and very often we had to spend the daytime guard up in the attic of this castle. And there were shells that had come through the roof from time to time, and it wasn't very encouraging when you were up there and to think that they were about to do it to you again. Fortunately, nobody ever seemed to get hurt from these shells that came through the roof. But from my point of view, the most exciting thing that happened in the course of this week was what I've always come to regard as my naval battle. It began, I have to say, with a most enormously amusing leg pull. I went out on a foot patrol of some kind, and I was away for several hours, and when I came back, I was confronted by a rifleman, again, a Kingsrow rifleman who'd been transferred in, Taffy something or other, very, very Welsh miner. He buttonholed me at once. "Oh," he said, "Don," he said, I got some special message for you, man." He said, "You got to go down the company stores." I said, "Oh, why?" He said, "Oh, you got to draw your webbed feet." He said, "You're going across the river tomorrow." I said, "Webbed feet?" "Oh, yes, man," he said, "it's very special." He said, "You've got to go down there at once." He said, "Go and ask the storeman for your webbed feet." Well, I suppose I was a bit tired, and I bought this hook, line, and sinker. And I duly went down to the stores, and I said, "I've come here for my webbed feet." He said, "What, mate?" I said, "My webbed feet." I said, "I've got to draw a pair of webbed feet." He said, "You, you've been having a go on, mate." Suddenly I said, "Oh God." But indeed there was to be a water patrol the following day, but webbed feet were not involved. But the storeman did tell me that what was involved was canvas boats. Sure enough, it appeared that our section had been detailed to take three canvas boats across the floodwaters to find out exactly where Battalion HQ was located, and also to make contact and pick up a new officer who joined Battalion HQ. I thought at one time that he was adjutant, but I don't think he could have been. He must have been in some other capacity. Anyway, he didn't stay very long, as you will hear. He was a veteran of the Middle Eastern desert, and he had the MC, and we were always very pleased to find these experienced people around. They were usually pretty reliable, and we were quite looking forward to seeing him. So we duly set off across the floodwater in these three canvas boats, collapsible boats, with paddles. And the particular boat that I was in was really the flagship, because we had Brian Neal in command, our platoon commander. Incidentally, I hadn't mentioned it before, but I think by this time I'd already got my second stripe, so I was, so to speak, the first lieutenant on this particular ship. I think one of the others was commanded by Stan Triggs, but who was in the third, I can't remember. Anyway, it was in our boat that this officer was due to come back, and we had two or three riflemen paddling. Well, as I mentioned earlier, this Castel was on the banks of the River Maas, and therefore our trip across the waters, the flooded waters, would have to be away from the River Maas. But as all the ground was flooded, it was quite difficult to see exactly where the river was, except that there was a little bit of a dike between it and the flooded water. There was a similar dike on the other side, and actually we could see the Germans from time to time walking along the river bank. We didn't snipe at them or anything, and they didn't snipe at us. Although I don't think we were quite so careless as they were as to walk along on our side. Actually, at one occasion I saw a rather stout and rather elderly German soldier actually conveying some cows down the riverbank, whether for milking or for slaughter, I don't know. So we set out away from the river, and I was posted up in the prow with a pair of wire cutters. And of course there was barbed wire between fields occasionally, and the barbed wire, if it stood up and impeded our progress, then I leaned out of the boat, cut the barbed wire, and we sailed over the top of it. And at first everything went very smoothly. Our three boats travelled over the waters at a fair lick, abreast, and very soon, after about half a mile or mile, something like that, we began to see a bit of dry land, a bit of raised land, which was to be the rendezvous where we were to meet this officer, and sure enough, there he was waiting for us. We came ashore and met him for the very first time. But at the time that it had taken us to get away from the river and up to this dry land to meet this officer, two things had happened. The first was that the waters had gone down a bit. They'd subsided. This meant that the barbed wire was further up than it had been before, and therefore there was more of it. The other thing, which we didn't know at the time, was that the Germans had spotted us, and they'd filled in the time by bringing up a self-propelled gun or tank waiting for our return. And sure enough, as soon as we started to return, or when we got within their sight, they began to shell us. I'd never been so terrified in my life. As I say, the barbed wire was now standing up further than ever, and I was having to lean further and further forward in the boat in order to cut it as we came to it, and it took longer to cut than it had done on the way out. Much longer. So there we were. Imagine it. Three 12-foot long canvas boats, absolutely no armor or any kind of protection at all, out as sitting targets on this water, and perhaps about half a mile to go towards the shore. So what could we do to be saved? If we got out of the boat, We'd be blown to pieces by the blast in the water. If we stayed in the boat, if they managed to hit us, well, then we went the same way. It was Hobson's choice. Of course, the first shells they dropped were sighting shells, and they were beginning to bracket us to get our measure. And that was enough to galvanize us into pretty severe action. Anyway, our only possible salvation lay in that dike on the rim of the river, on the bank. Once we could get under the lee of that and change our direction a bit, they wouldn't be able to sight themselves on us. So obviously that was the target. Get as soon as we possibly could under the lee of that bank. Meanwhile, the distance we had to go under this fire was quite daunting. But once under that cover of the bank, we'd be able to ditch the boats and run for it. Wade first and then run for it. So that was obviously the target. So I leaned ever further out of the front of the boat, and in a statement that was perhaps, in retrospect, pricelessly obvious, Captain Bligh Neal said, "Corporal Gillett, as soon as we get to the barbed wire," he said, "cut it as soon as you can." So I said, "That's all right, sir. I shall cut it long before that." My reference to Captain Bligh, so far as Neal was concerned, was not out of place. He was standing, actually standing in the boat at the blunt end with his hand behind his back, looking for all the world like a naval officer and giving his instructions. He behaved thoroughly bravely because none of the rest of us was actually standing. We were all seated. Not that it mattered very much. If it was going to get you, it would get you whether you were on your feet or your bottom. Certainly I had myself never been so technically accurate with a pair of secateurs in my life. I was really cutting for dear life, literally. And the paddlers were paddling for dear life too. Well, we all knew that it would only take one hit and we would all be for Davy Jones' locker. But by an absolute miracle, they didn't make it. We managed to get to our safe water under the lee of that bank, heaven knows how, and as soon as possible we pulled the boats up onto as dry a piece of land as we could and made a run for it. So far, no casualties whatever. But meanwhile, what had happened to our passenger, the officer that we collected? We hadn't really had time to give him a thought, and suddenly we noticed there he was on the bottom of the boat, lying on the bottom of the boat, shaking and blubbering like an infant. His nerve had completely gone. So as soon as it was practicable, we got him out of the boat and pushed him towards safety. And that was that. We never saw him again, naturally, because this was a disgraceful performance. Well, I suppose on these occasions one has to be charitable, and we were rather hoping that, being a Middle Eastern veteran, he'd be showing us the way. But the other side of that coin is that he'd probably seen so much action before that he'd really had enough. He'd had battle fatigue before he even got into battle. Well, fortunately for us, nothing else exciting happened while we were there at the Castel, except that the barn that we had been occupying at one stage got very badly shelled, and if we'd been in it, we'd all been killed, but as a matter of fact, we weren't in it, so it didn't matter. Apart from that, nothing else exciting happened except that the Germans walked their cows up and down the bank there, and we didn't bring up any self-propelled guns to knock them about. We were much too gentlemanly. Anyway, we continued in a fairly nomadic way for the next few days, in and out of the Castile and other places, and we were in a rather indefinite condition until the 13th of December. And on that day, we moved up to relieve the 1st Herefordshire Regiment at Grubenfurst. And our company was reserve company, being about a mile west of the Maas on the railway line. All we did there was to send a platoon forward to the river every night, but we didn't stay there very long, because on the 15th, advance parties were sent off to Poppering, back in Belgium. Think of that. What did it all mean? Well, we couldn't really believe what it did mean. We were promised that we were going to spend Christmas in Poppering among the friendly Belgians, and we were going to have a complete rest, and we were going to get new tanks. We couldn't believe our luck. This didn't happen to us. And we all started talking learnedly about this new British tank, which they called the Comet, which was to replace the Shermans. Well, in fact, by that time, we were so fed up with the Shermans that if they'd offered us bows and arrows, we'd have been perfectly happy. We didn't think there could be anything worse. And so we were quite looking forward to better times, so far as the tank power was concerned. They were supposed to be much lower slung and much better armoured, and therefore, for the final assault on Germany, we felt that we were in safer hands. So the advance party went off on the 15th then, and we started off on the 16th in hot pursuit. Well, it was a ghastly journey, particularly having to travel by night. But who the hell cared? We were coming ever and ever further away from the line. And that was really the first time we'd done that. And finally, as promised, we arrived at Poppering. Now, Poppering, you may remember, was in the First World War the place where the Toc-H movement started. Well, by definition, the local population were extremely pro-British, and if we were going to spend Christmas there, our cup of happiness couldn't have been more full. Our next objective was to get cleaned up and reorganized and have a nice rest before Christmas. The advance party had done their job very well. They hadn't had very long to do it, but by the time we got there, they were very well organized indeed. They knew exactly who was sleeping with whom, or may I rephrase that and say, who was billeted upon whom. So all we had to do was to refuel the vehicles and unload them, and then, would you believe, to sink into actual beds with real sheets. We couldn't believe our luck. But as it happens, our particular company was not actually in Poppering itself. We were in a nearby village called Proven. But it didn't matter. It was heaven. Quite early on, however, we had a little spot of bother over a young man called Hendrik Jan Lederboer. He was a young Dutchman, a resistance man, whom we'd picked up soon after we'd come into Holland, and he had been fixed up with a uniform, and although we couldn't officially take him on the strength, he was absolutely determined to be a member of H Company, the 8th Rifle Brigade. And so if we'd had him with us and he'd been taken prisoner, of course he would have been shot if he'd been in civilian clothes, and he was so determined to hang on to us that we had to fit him out with a uniform of some kind. Well, he acted as an interpreter, and of course he was worth his weight in gold as long as we were going through Dutch or Flemish-speaking countries. But when we got to Poppering, he was unfortunately billeted upon a lady who was a Wallon. In other words, she didn't speak any Flemish or Dutch. And when she heard it explained to her in English that this man was Dutch, she thought that this was Deutsch. And so there was a bit of a schmozzle. So the true situation had to be explained to her in French. And at that point, of course, she was perfectly happy. Now, H Company of the 8th Battalion, the Rifle Brigade, has never lost touch with Hendrik Jan Lederboer. He won't allow it, nor do we want it. We've seen him in the last few years attending the London Rifle Brigade lunches in London, and he's always welcome, and he's delighted to come. So we're going to spend the next few days absolutely de-gutting our vehicles. We took absolutely everything off, and it was the first time we'd seen the floor since we'd left England. The floor of the carrier, I mean. We were going to demilitarize ourselves absolutely with everything in store. So during the next 48 hours, when we were getting these things off, the main street of Little Proven looked like a boot fair or junk market. We got all our stuff on the sides of the roads, covered with the tarpaulin. We cleaned up all the weapons, and there were bits of vehicles all over the place. Every scrap of it had to be scrubbed up. And then we felt entitled to put our feet up. What happened next is probably best summarized in the H Company diary account. Quote, "Never since D-Day had we been so completely and ruthlessly become non-operational. So it was nothing new for the experienced to be told at breakfast this morning, that's December the 20th, that we were under orders to move within 3 hours, completely warlike again, for the Ardennes region. 1200 hours. In some extraordinary way, we were already in time. Loading in a hurry has always been our strong point. On schemes under Major Mackenzie, life had been something like living in a railway sorting office. But it bore fruit today, and amid the cheers and tears of Proven's female population, the company moved off. It meant that von Rundstedt had made his move in the Ardennes, soon to be known as the Battle of the Bulge, and we'd been invited to the party. Well, thank you very much, Uncle Rundstedt. But were we downhearted? Well, yes, we were, actually. It was queasy stomach time again. Now, it seems that we received this invitation because we appeared to be the only troops available to be able to go up to the line of the River Meuse and seize the three bridges over the Meuse at Namur, Dinan, and Givet, which von Rundstedt would have to cross in order to make a scything movement round to the Channel ports and cut the entire British army off, much as they had done in 1940. I think it was a clear case of their wanting to boil the same cabbage twice, or to do what Montgomery had failed to do at Caen, and that is to repeat a victory that he'd had elsewhere. Anyway, that was our task, to go and seize these three bridges. Because if von Rundstedt had succeeded and had seized the Channel ports, he'd have cut off the entire Allied armies and he'd have been able to masticate them at will, much as he did the British army and French in 1940. So, off to defend these bridges, we duly went. It was an even more unpleasant journey than the one we'd had down to Poperinghe. We made what we thought a rather needless trip round the south of Brussels, and we were shelled there, in fact, and we also met our first buzz bombs. And if that was one of the evils of the trip, the other one was the fact that at least when we were going to Poperinghe, we knew we were going out of action, and here we knew we were going into it. One of the nights that we spent on this trip, and it was a very, quite a long trip, was in a large barren school with the lights fully ablaze all the time. We couldn't sleep, of course. But I suppose we should be grateful for the school because another advanced party working very skillfully had ensured that we were all under cover. We weren't expected to sleep out in the open in this mid-December. So December the 21st found us in the little town of Givet, which is just about in France on the Franco-Belgian border. That was the one that we, H Company, were to hold with our friends, the 23rd Hussars, with whom we were going to work again. And if between us we couldn't hold those bridges, we would blow them. Them was our orders. For some astounding reason, there were already 3,000 American troops in Givet. And as they felt it was their duty to look after the bridge, there were at least 30 people guarding the bridge every night. It was a little overmanned. Too many Indians, you might say, and not enough chiefs, because nobody was left to find out what was going on. And it's hardly surprising to find that the place was absolutely a hotbed of rumor. It was the first time we'd seen a German attack on this scale, and everybody, of course, assumed that the Germans were superhuman and capable of absolutely everything underhand, not to mention overhand. Things, indeed, which couldn't be coped with by the Allies. Characteristic among the rumors was the one that there were three Germans disguised as monks somewhere among us. They turned out to be Frenchmen and monks in any case, and therefore there was no foundation to it. But that was the sort of thing that we were beginning to hear every day. That's the end of cassette number 6, side 1.